So let's begin with the riff. Originally, when I first announced the schedule, I announced first the relationship between Bavli and Yerushalmi, two centers, Bavli and Eretz Yisrael, and then to move to Ashkenaz and Sfarad. So it turns out that the issue of Bavli and Eretz Yisrael is a very complex one, and it's getting more complicated. There's a lot of scholarship that's very recent on this issue that I have not been on top of, and therefore decided that I would move away from that. We'll save it for a time when hopefully I'll have more of an opportunity to delve into it. And we'll start with the riff, because the riff is also an example of somebody who went from here to there. Although he himself didn't go to Ashkenaz, there's a very important tshuva of the riff that we'll see, which stands out as an example of the relationship between Sfarad and Ashkenaz. So let's start with the riff. To start with the riff, I want to distribute a map. So you don't mind taking, I want to distribute a map. You need to have a sense of the map in order to understand what we're talking about and where the countries are and how far A is from B. So the Rif lives in the 11th century. The Rif is born around the year 1013, and the Rif is Nifter in 1103. He lives virtually throughout the entire 11th century. Just to place the Rif, it's important to understand that the Rif is a contemporary of Rashi, and the Rif is a contemporary of the Baal HaOruch. Rashi is in Ashkenaz. The Rif is in Kairouan. We're going to talk a lot about Kairouan, North Africa, and in Spain. And the Aruch, the Baal HaOruch, is in Italy. So you have three people living at the same time, each one making a different contribution to rabbinic literature. The Rif is the codifier. The Rif writes a code. It's very different from the Rambam's code. It's not as comprehensive as the Rambam's code. It's a code. And we'll see how already Rishonim referred to the Rif as the Mechaber of a Talmud Katan, the Talmud Katan, or a Talmud Zeira. So that's what the Rif is doing. The Rif is working on code. Rashi is working on commentary. And the Aruch is working on a lexicon. The Aruch, as you know, is a dictionary. So you find three different people living mamish at the same time, each chipping away or attacking or trying to be masbir rabbinic literature, each in a different way. The Rif is probably born in Algeria. If you take a look at the map, Algeria is at the bottom right-hand side of the map. The bottom, almost the bottom right, you see Tunis. That's North Africa is at the bottom of this map. I did as best as I could. I'm sorry if it's not as clear as I would hope that it would be. So you see Tunis in big letters. South of Tunis is Kairouan. Kairouan is today in Tunisia. Tunis is the capital of Tunisia. To the left of Tunis is Algeria. Algeria is the country that's immediately west of Tunisia. That's where probably the Rif was born, in Algeria, and he comes to Kairouan. Kairouan was founded in 670. By the Arab conquerors of North Africa. It's a major city, Bichlal. And by the 9th century, Jews are pretty much clearly ensconced in the city of Kairouan. We know about it from the Cairo Geniza, and also there are a number of Tshuvas HaGa'inim that intersect between the Ga'inim and Kairouan. There's a huge yeshiva in Kairouan, which was founded by Rab Chushiel b'Rab Elchanan. To understand who Rab Chushiel b'Rab Elchanan is, first of all, you may know his son better. His son was Rabbeinu Chananel, who also lived in Kairouan. The Rabbeinu Chananel on the side of the Gemara of a number of Mesechtis. But Rabbeinu Chushiel's arrival in North Africa brings us to a very, very important story that's found in the Sefer HaKabbalah, or the Seder HaKabbalah of Abraham Ibn Daud. So if you take a look at page 1, I xeroxed for you from the Sefer, or the Seder HaKabbalah, of Abraham Ibn Daud. Abraham Ibn Daud was known as the Ravid. He's not our Ravid, he's the other Ravid. In fact, there's a third Ravid. There are a number of Ravids. There's a Provençal Ravid, and there's a Spanish Ravid, and there's another Provençal Ravid. He's known as the Ravid. And he publishes a book, he writes a book in the middle of the 12th century called either Sefer HaKabbalah or Seder HaKabbalah. This is the definitive scholarly edition that was published in 1967 by Gerson Cohen. The long introduction with the original Hebrew and with an English translation. This is a very important book written in the middle of the 12th century because it defends rabbinic tradition, it defends the Mesorah, particularly against the Karaites. Tremendous amount of Karaite upheaval during this time. Today, it's a very small, tiny group in our tradition. Basically, we don't have to deal with Karaites today. In medieval times, there were places where the Karaites outnumbered even the Rabbinites. Karaites were a very significant force. Without going into a whole analysis of Karaism, Karaism at its core presented a position that undermined the Mesorah as we understood it. And one of the things, and maybe even the most central thing that the Sefer HaKabbalah or Seder HaKabbalah attempts to do is to polemicize against the Karaites by presenting a Mesorah from generation to generation. This Ravid, Abraham Ibn Daud, is born in Cordoba. He's born in southern Spain. And in 1148, the Almohades attack southern Spain. Now, the Almohades are very important for the biography of the Rambam, because the Rambam is also living at this time. The Rambam is also living in Cordoba. The Rambam's father, Rav Maimon HaDayan, is the Dayan in Cordoba. The Almohades are a radical Muslim sect, comes out of North Africa, comes to southern Spain. From North Africa to southern Spain is from this side of the shul to the other side of the shul. You could see at the tip of North Africa, you could see the tip of Spain. And they conquer southern Spain and they give Jews a choice, those who were living in southern Spain, of either conversion or death, decimating thereby, obviously, a thriving, relatively thriving Jewish community that was living in the southern part of Spain. So the Rambam and his family run away, and Abraham Ibn Daud and his family run away. A lot of Jews run away. It's a whole discussion, just agav urcha, much more relevant to the biography, 1148. Much more relevant to the biography of the Rambam, and that is about forced conversion and did the Jews convert or not. The Rambam paskens in Igeres Hashmad. The Rambam is mechalek between if somebody forces you to convert to Christianity and somebody forces you to convert to Islam. Somebody forces you to convert to Christianity, l'shita sarambam, Christianity is avodah zarah, so it's one of the three, yehoreg val yavar. However, Islam, says the Rambam in a number of places, most famous in a very well-known tshuva to Rabbi Avadya Hager, very well-known tshuva, where he excoriates anybody who says that Islam is avodah zarah, chas v'shalom, it's not avodah zarah. Already for a long time, it's not avodah zarah. So therefore, l'shitoso, if it's not avodah zarah, so if somebody forces you to convert to Islam or be killed, so it's not one of the three major averis, and adarabah yemuchuyev to convert to Islam. So when I was young, long time ago, I heard this tradition that in fact the Rav Maimon HaDayan himself and his family, including the Rambam, also in keeping with this halacha for a short period of time, Klapei Chutz converted to Islam and ran away as soon as they could, because the Rambam says, even lahalacha, even if you could convert to Islam, doesn't mean that you have to machza chemish in Islam. It means you have to get out of there as soon as possible. So in fact, for a short period of time, the family converted to Islam. So I found it very hard to live with that and to accept that, even though it's in keeping with the Rambam's own position. And then about 3-4 years ago, a professor, Mordechai Akiva Friedman, who's a professor of Islamic studies at the Hebrew University, published a very, very important book, a very coveted book. It has Igeres Hashmad, her Rambam in the title, and he's actually not prepared to just simply dismiss this tradition. So, once again, it's Chayzer Veneer in my mind as maybe being a possibility. Al Kopanim, the Rambam and his family go south into North Africa. Our Ravid, Abraham Ibn Daud, goes north, and he ends up in Toledo. We're going to have a lot to say about Toledo when we come to talk about Here's a map. When we come to talk about the Rush, so I'm passing around a map of Spain. If you look at the map of Spain, Toledo's right in the middle. Toledo today, if you go to Spain, Toledo is an hour by bus south of Madrid. It's actually very close to Madrid. In Middle Ages, there was no such thing as Madrid. Madrid was a davar shalei bolo olam. There was no Madrid. Toledo was the ir ve'en b'Yisrael. We'll talk a lot about Toledo, not Toledo. Toledo is in Ohio. Toledo is in Spain. That's where the Rush came, and we'll talk about this city when we have a little bit of a background. So he comes to Toledo. That's where he writes his book, and it's an anti-Karaite polemic. So he writes as follows. The cover page is on page 1. This begins section number 7. Section number 7 is the bulk of the book, where there's a sort of shalshelas ha-kabbalah. There's a shalshelas ha-mesorah. Yet one side has Spain, and the other side has something else. One side has Spain, the other side has Germany. Now we're looking at Spain. We'll come to Germany, one step at a time. So beginning from page 2 to page 8, I Xeroxed the original. And then beginning on page 10, I Xeroxed the English translation. So we're going to work off of the English translation. You have the original right here in case you want to refer to it. But it's going to be a little bit easier for us. Abraham Ibn Dao tells a story that's known as the story of the four captives. And what he tells here is this really interesting story that describes how Torah learning came to Western Europe and came to North Africa. How is it that the Mesorah ended up in these communities where until now there really was very little? We know about Eretz Yisrael, and we know about Bavel, and we know about Italy. Italy was a tremendous Makom Torah. We'll come back and talk about this. Italy was a major Makom Torah. Did I give you a map of Italy yet? So here comes a map of France, Portugal, Spain, France, Italy, and Germany, and England. This is a map of Western Europe. So Italy is a major Makom Torah. Jews come to Italy after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, after Churban Bayis Sheni. Already the Gemara Maseches Gittin tells us that Titus brought Jews and Klei HaMikdash with him to Rome. After all, Rome is what conquered the Bayis Sheni. So a lot of Jews are exiled and come to Rome. There's already a small Jewish community in Rome at the time, but it gets effaced, it gets overwhelmed by the newcomers, and Italy becomes a very significant Makom Torah, particularly the back of the boot. The two major cities, we'll talk about them shortly, one is Bari and one is Otranto. Bari and Otranto. If you look on the map, you don't see either Bari or Otranto, but it's in the back of the boot. Also, a little bit further north, there was also a yeshiva. Italy was a very significant Makom Torah. So Abraham Ibn Daud wants to understand, how did Torah come to Spain? How did Torah come to Germany? How did Torah come to North Africa? So he tells a story. Story is told, page 10 in the binder, the succession of the rabbinate. There was a Muslim fleet that was plying the high seas in order to be able to capture ships and to make money off of the booty that they would capture. And they sailed as far as the coast of Palestine, line 10, page 63, page 10 in the binder, swung about to the Greek Sea and the islands herein. Here they encountered a ship carrying four great scholars, I'm on page 11, who were traveling from the city of Bari to a city called Sfastin. So Cohen in his notes says, we don't know anything about Sfastin, but we know a great deal about Bari. Ad kedei kach, as we will see, Rabbeinu Tam says in the Sefer HaYosher, if you want to get a sense about the godless of Torah in Bari, he says, and it's actually shtickel audacious, and we'll talk about this, Ad kedei kach ki mi Bari teitzei Torah, udevar Hashem, Meo Toronto. It's a Beferish Sefer HaYosher of Rabbeinu Tam. It's a shtickel audacious because you know what the original is. And to say that Bari is Tzion and Otranto is Yerushalayim takes a certain amount of whatever you want to fill in, it takes that. To identify Bari and Otranto, Keneged, Tzion and Yerushalayim. But it gives you... What? Kimi Bari Teitze Torah Udavar Hashem Meo Toronto. In fact, if you want, take a look in the general section. Let's start putting things together. Take a look in the general section, which is the next section on page 17. After the riff, the next section is the general section. Zayzirax from the Sefer Yosha the Rabbeinu Tam. Actually, I'm a Halshen Dabai. A Xerox from a better edition, which is now going around, of the Sefer Yosha the Rabbeinu Tam. The Sefer Yosha on page 17. It's page 17 in the general section of the binder. In the left-hand column, where it's underlined, right before it's underlined. Umehem Torah Yotzes. It's about 7-8 lines down from the left-hand side at the end of the paragraph. Umehem Torah Yotzes. Noagu Kamoni Gam Bnei Bari. Do you have it? It's the beginning of the line. Shahoya Korin Alehem. Shtel Zachfar. Kimi Bari Teitze Torah. Udvar Hashem Meotranto, page 17. What? On the left-hand side, right before where the underline is. Do you have an underline in the sheet? Two lines before the underline. Noagu kamoni gam b'nei bari, shahayu korin alehen kimi bari. Unbelievable. Shtel zechfar, kimi bari teitze torah dvar Hashem Yerushalayim. Let's go back to our story. So Bari's a makom Torah, so that there are a whole bunch of Talmidei Chachamim who are traveling from Bari somewhere, and they're on the boat, and they're on the way to learn. They're on the way to a Kala convention.
So if they're going to
they're going to a Yarchei Kala.
If the Yarchei Kala is in Sfasid, wouldn't that be the center of Torah?
So they're going to there to be Marbitz Torah in Sfasid. They probably had a retreat center in Sfasid. The Makom Torah is in Bari, but Sfasid was a Mechaya to go to. So they all came to the place where there was going to be comfortable. Ibn Ruchamis captured the ship and took the sages prisoner. One of them was Rabbeinu Chushiel, the father of Rabbeinu Chananel. It's because of this line that I'm introducing this now. In order to understand the riff, you have to understand who Rabbeinu Chushiel was. In order to understand Rabbeinu Chushiel, the purpose is to understand Rabbeinu Chananel. Rabbeinu Chananel was one of the Rabbeim of the riff. Rabbeinu Nisim was another one of the Rabbeim of the riff. We'll see in a moment. So, Rabbeinu Chushiel, the father of Rabbeinu Chananel. The second one is Rabbi Moshe, the father of Rav Chanoch, who was taken prisoner with his wife and son. The third is Rab Shemariah, the son of Rabbi Elchanan. And the fourth one, I don't know who he was. I always feel badly for the fourth one, Nebuch. I could give an afayne Talmud Chacham. But for all of posterity, we don't know who he is, because Abraham Ibn Daud didn't know. The others we know. Then there's a parenthetical story that I want to read to you and come back to. And then we'll go weiter. Let's actually skip the parenthetical story for a moment. And we'll come back to it. Line 25. So they're all captured. All these great rabbis in one shot are captured. These sages did not tell a soul about themselves or their wisdom. So the commander sold Reb Shemaiah in Alexandria of Egypt. And Reb Shemaiah went to Fustat, where he became the head of the academy. Then he sold Rabbeinu Chushiel on the coast of Africa, and from there he went to Kairouan, which at that time was the mightiest of all Muslim cities in the Maghreb. The Maghreb is North Africa, where he became head of the academy, and where he begot his son Rabbeinu Chananel. And then the commander arrived at Cordova, where he sold Rabbi Moses along with Rabbi Chanoch. Then he tells a story. Now's not the time, you'll read it. There's a shtickle yeshiva there, and Rabbi Moshe walks in, and there's somebody who's trying to echo Becca through a shir, and he quotes a Gemara in Yuma, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. And they start to ask him, and he's not sure, and diffidently Rav Meisha gets up, and he clarifies the whole thing, and they turn to him, who is this person? They didn't know who he was a big Nechba al-Akelim, and they realize he was a big Talmud Chacham, so they ended up sending away the other one, and making him, he should become the Rosh Yeshiva, and that's where Torah scholarship began to really develop in Spain. And if you look on page 13, the reason why the king is so delighted, and this is the Chlal conversation, I just want to mention it to you. The king is delighted by the fact that the Jews of his domain no longer had need of the people of Babylonia. What happens now is that the king in Spain wants to develop his own kingdom separate from the Islamic Caliphate, and the Jewish community in Spain now is beginning to develop its independence from Babel. So you have a confluence of interest of the local Jewish community and of the king, both of whom want to establish a separate entity, an independent entity in Spain. So even though in previous generations, the earlier generations of Spanish Jews were very much tied in to the Gaonim, the major tshuva of Seder of Amram Gaon, the Seder of Amram Gaon, the first tshuva, the first sitter that we have, is a tshuva of the Gaonim, Rav Amram, to probably Barcelona, probably to a city in Spain. So there's a close connection between Spanish Jewry and the Gaonim, and now it's beginning to break away. I want to just take a moment before we come back to the riff and go back to this parenthetical comment in Abraham Ibn Daud, and suggest something to you that you might be able to use separate from the riff, and it's usable in general, and particularly around the time of Yom HaShoah. So I'm now passing around something else. As I pass it around, I'm going to read page 11, the parenthetical story here right in the middle. Line 18. He tells you, Mitten Derinin, on the boat, that the commander wanted to violate Rabbi Moses, his wife, inasmuch as she was exceedingly beautiful. Thereupon she cried out in Hebrew to her husband, Rav Moshe, and asked him whether or not those who drown in the sea will be quickened at the time of the resurrection of the dead. So the question was, if she's going to throw herself over the boat into the water and she's going to drown, so is she forfeiting her chelik and olam haba? We know that suicide is not a good thing. So if somebody commits suicide, even under these circumstances, is she saving herself from one terrible thing, but is she now getting in trouble with something else? So he tells her, Pasuk says, Hashem yiboshan ashiv, ashiv b'mitzulos yam, God will bring you back from the depths of the sea. Having heard his reply, she cast herself into the sea and she drowned. Now this story wags a long tail in our tradition. And what I want to do is I want to give you an example from the 2nd century, this is from the 10th century, then from the 17th century, and then from the 20th century. This is now agav urcha, once we're here already, to bring something else to your attention. So if you look at the Yevei Metzula that I distributed, let's start actually earlier. If you go a little bit further back in this section, to a Gemara in Hanizaka Nunvav Amidays. So the Gemara tells us a famous story in Hanizaka and Daf Nunvav Amidays. The Gemara tells a very similar story. Maisa Bedalad Meos Yeladim V'Yelados Shenishbu Lekalon. It's a story that we learn, the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nunvav Nun Zayin Amidays. The Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nun Zayin Amidays. These are Jews, boys and girls, who were captured in Yerushalayim and were being taken to Italy by Titus after Churban Bayis Sheni. And they knew what was waiting for them in Rome, that there was going to be inappropriate behavior. So they went through, you'll see the Gemara, where they went through the same thing. Are we going to throw ourselves overboard? Are we forfeiting our share in Olam Haba? And the answer was, he quoted from the same Pasuk, Amar Hashem Yibosha Noshev Hashev Mimitzulos Yam. So they all, one after another, they threw themselves into the sea in order to save themselves from this terrible fate, with the confidence that they're not forfeiting the Sharon Olam Haba. This same story is found in Medrash Eicha, which I Xerox right afterward, on the next page, on the Pasuk of Al-Ela Ani Bochia, the beginning of Medrash Eicha, Al-Ela Ani Bochia. So here's another version of the exact same story. Here it says, Pazyanos Milei Shalosh Sfinos Migedole Yerushalayim Lahoshivon Bekalon Shalom. So we're in the second century, we find this whole drama playing itself out. Here in Abraham Ibn Daud, in the Sefer HaKabbalah, we find it being played out in the story of the four captives, which allegedly took place somewhere around the 10th century. Now look at the beginning of this section. The beginning of the section is the Sefer Yevein Metzula. The Sefer Yevein Metzula is the most famous chronicle written during the Khmelnytsky massacres. Shortly after the first round of the Khmelnytsky massacres, in Hebrew, we know them as Gzeros Tachvetat, 1648, 1649. So in 1650, there's a respite. Rav Nosson Nota Hanover is a huge makubal, and we know about him from other Sfarim that are Kuloi Kabbalah, wrote as a survivor of the Khmelnytsky massacres. He wrote the most well-known chronicle describing what happened. We have four other smaller chronicles that describe what happened in the Khmelnytsky massacres. His is the largest and the most interesting. And he tells us similar stories. He tells us on page 37, and he tells us on page 39 and 40, and I Xerox the English for you afterwards, so you'll have it in case you want to use it in English. Stories are similar about what happened to girls who gave up their lives, who allowed themselves to be killed rather than submit to inappropriate sexual behavior on the part of the Ukrainians. He tells us first in general that there are women who jumped in and drowned themselves so that this shouldn't happen. And then he tells us two specific stories. And it's the same typology. It's a typology of giving up your life rather than falling into the hands of those, Ira, rather than falling into the hands of those who would mistreat you in a sexual way. So we have the second century, we have the Sefer HaKabbalah, the 10th century, we have the Yevei Metzula, the 17th century, and what I'm passing around now is the 20th century. This was actually recently, in light of the most recent Yom HaShoah, this was big on the blogs, this particular story about the 93 Beis Yaakov girls. So you'll see in an article that I'm passing around, there was a whole story about 93 Beis Yaakov girls in Krakow. This comes from the New York Times on January 8th, 1943. We wonder how much did the American Jewry know, how much did we not know. So on January 8th, 1943, is an article in the New York Times. It was submitted to the New York Times by my predecessor at the Jewish Center, by Rabbi Leo Young, Zichrono Levracha. Rabbi Leo Young, whose name appears in this article, was very close with the Beis Yaakov movement. Rabbi Young was responsible for the building of the first Beis Yaakov in Krakow with Sarah Schneer in 1927. He told me a lot of stories about Sarah Schneer. It's very fascinating. And Rabbi Young had a very interesting filing system. When I came to the Jewish Center in 1981, he was already 90, and I was not yet 30. So he was the rabbi emeritus, and I was the rabbi. And I became very close with him, and our offices were next to one another. And whenever he came across something interesting, he would call me into his office. So his filing system was that if he wanted to save something, he put it into the book he happened to be reading at that time. So this way he knew he would save it. This way he knew he wouldn't throw it away. So one day he's reading a book and he opens it up and out falls this old yellowed fadorbana copy of the New York Times from January 8th, 1943. And he called me into his office and he showed me. So this story is the 20th century story. Now at the very end of the packet, I Xerox for you just the first page of an article that I wrote many years ago dealing with this story. It was in a book I put out in memory of Rabbi Young, Reverence, Righteousness, Rachmanus, Essays in Memory of Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. So in that book, I co-authored an article with Judy Tidor Baumol, who's a leading expert of Holocaust studies in Israel, on this story. I didn't Xerox the whole article here. If anybody's interested, let me know and I'll be happy to bring it to your attention. I'll call Panim. What do we have? We have offline an amazing repetition of a similar typology from the Gemara Medrash Eicha, 2nd century, from Sefer HaKabbalah, 10th century, from Yevei Metzula, 17th century, and from Beis Yaakov Girls in Krakow in the 20th century. Whether the story happened as it's presented or did not happen, that's the subject of my article, but the story certainly could have happened and is yet another example of this whole phenomenon. So that's something that in general is just an interesting case study to trace historically from through the generations. Now let's go back to the Rif. So Rabbeinu Chushiel comes to Kairouan. Kairouan is a big Makom Torah. There's a city today in Tunisia called Kairouan. This past summer, YU ran a cruise to the western Mediterranean, and I was the historian on the cruise, and one of the stops that we made was Tunis. We stopped in Tunis. It's unbelievable. It's a Jewish community in Tunis in the year 2008. It was this past summer. It's amazing. It's a huge shul in Mitten Derinin, right in the middle of Tunis. It's like Central Park West in the middle of Manhattan with a huge Magen David. It's like you're in an Arab country. Vumegitza Chadre, you're in an Arab country. But it's a huge shul. And Avi Yeshiva, it's amazing. In Tunis today, in 2008. About 80 miles south of Tunis is Kairouan. We didn't have a chance to get to Kairouan, but it's still a city. It's pretty shvachamaisis. There are no Jews at all living anymore in Kairouan. But Kairouan became a very important center and had a major yeshiva, and that's where Rabbeinu Chushiel came, according to this story, captured in the boat. Now, scholars have all kinds of sfeikas about, did the story really happen exactly the way it's presented? Anything you wanted to know about this and more, you can read in Gerson Cohen's introduction. But the goal here is to explain whether the Pratim are exactly 100%. The goal here is to explain how did Torah get to Spain? How did Torah get to Egypt? How did Torah get to Kairouan? How did Torah get to North Africa? Now, From Italy, Rabbeinu Chushiel brings Talmud Yerushalmi. And this is what I mentioned earlier. There's a lot of material now coming out about Bavli Yerushalmi and how much did Sfarad and Ashkenaz know Yerushalmi and when did Ashkenaz get to know Yerushalmi. It's all of it is not really clear. But Eretz Yisrael went to Italy and Italy went to Ashkenaz. In fact, as we'll see, just to adumbrate something that we'll see later, Ashkenaz was not necessarily Bavli-centric all the time, and sometimes was Yerushalmi-centric. And so I'm going to show you, Lamashal, a case where you want to understand the Nusach in Ashkenaz based on a Yerushalmi as opposed to a Bavli. I'm going to show you a case, and the case is, I'll tell you, in the Unisana Toke, if we say Tfilah Tshuva Tfilah Tztaka Mavir Nesro Agzera, so the Marsha is going to ask, after all, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says more than three things. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says four things, V'yeshomrim five things. Azirax did for you in the Chomer Lidra section. So the Marsha asks, Vaseis, why do we choose Tshuva Tfilah Tztaka if the Gemara has four or five? And the answer is very simple. Because the Yerushalmi and the Medrash Brachos Rabbah, which is from Eretz Yisrael, Kaka only have three. And the Minag Ashkenaz is based on the Yerushalmi. It's not necessarily based on the Bavli. We are so Bavli-centric in our learning that the Marsha's Kasha makes perfect sense. It's a Beferish Gemara. How could the Piyut say something that's problematic in light of a Beferish Gemara? But if you understand how the Shalshalas HaMesorah works, so it's not so pashit that Ashkenaz was as rooted in Bavli, as it was at least at certain points in Yerushalm. So Rabbeinu Chushiel has a yeshiva in Kaira 1. Rabbeinu Chushiel has a son, Rabbeinu Chananel, who's born in Kaira 1, and continues the yeshiva, and is the Rebbe of the Rif. The Rif, as I mentioned, is born in Algeria, and he goes to learn in Kaira 1. At some point, he leaves to go to Fez, which is where he gets his name from, Al-Fasi. Fez is a city in Morocco. Fez is a magnificent city in Morocco. I was there 3 summers ago. It's a beautiful city. It used to be a very, very, very strong Jewish community. Today it's zero. There's not a single Jew who lives in Fez. Although we were shown in Fez, there's a house that has a sign on it that the Rambam lived here in this house. That as the Rambam, I mentioned to you, when he was a little boy, the Almohades came in 1148. He left Cordoba. He went to North Africa. And it's a gewalgert from south of Spain, which is Morocco, all the way across North Africa. He spent some time in Fez. Then he went up to Eretz Yisrael. We have famous letters of the Rambam describing when he went to the Harabayas, describing when he went to Hebron. But he fell into Eretz Yisrael at the time when the Christians had reconquered the Holy Land from the Muslims. So it was a time when the Christians had control of the Holy Land, and it was a very difficult time for Jews. So he couldn't make it, and he went back to Fustat. We already read about the yeshiva that was started in Fustat, and that's where he lived. So in the Shuk, in Fez, there's a house that says this is the Rambam's house. I was with a group of about 35 American Jews. I went to teach them about the history of the Jews in Morocco. They told us you can't wear a yarmulke. Can't wear a yarmulke in the streets, a Muslim country. So you have 35 Jews with tichlach and sheitlach and caps walking around, a few with beards walking around. It was only Shmeina Chas V'Shalom that they're Jews. We're trying to like slide right into the Muslim population, and we're all trying to find where's the Maimonides house, as if your average Muslim gate the man where the Maimonides is. Actually pretty hysterical, you know, the tzitzis past the jacket, and we're trying to make believe that nobody knows who we are, that we're a bunch of Jews in the middle of Fez. So the Rif comes to Fez, and then later in life he goes to Spain. He goes to Lucena. Lucena is in the southern part of Spain, and he has a yeshiva, and that's where he dies. Yeah.
The Arba Shvuyim came from Bavli, right?
Yeah, that's, I didn't say that. That's what he says.
So
the Arba Shvuyim came from Bavli.
That means they did not come from Bavli.
They came from Bavli, but they were influenced. No, they did not come from Bavli. They did not come from Bavli. They came from Bavli, and Bavli drew its yinika from Eretz Yisrael. And that's why the Spanish king was so excited when one of them came to Spain, because now he could circumvent the Babylonian hegemony.
I understand, but I thought I understood you to say that basically North Africa and Spain, their influence was from Bavli.
Their influence had been from Bavli, but now they want to break away. Now the Spanish king wants to create his new caliphate, not to be part of the Babylonian caliphate. So he's going to now get his independence, because the Jews are also now going to get their independence.
But in terms of Minhag and Nusach, all that?
It had started in Bavel. That's not for now. It's a whole conversation in terms of what is Bavel, what is Eretz Yisrael, what is the impact of Bavel and Eretz Yisrael, and where and for how long. Actually, I'm going to refer you, and I might as well do it now. There's one name that you have to know. You should have Mamash Alichtin Ganed and Yisrael Tashma. Yisrael Tashma was a Vailayit, an unbelievable, wonderful person, who learned in the traditional yeshivas as a boy, and then Jewish history at them gechapt, and he went to university, and he wrote books and articles and books and articles, and I'm going to be drawing heavily on his work, on the history of halacha. Most recently, a number of them were translated into English. This was published in 2006 by Harvard University Press. There are about 7 or 8 or 10 articles of Tashma here translated into English. It's called Creativity and Tradition, Studies in Medieval Rabbinic Scholarship, Literature, and Thought. So, Rabbi Yehuda, there's a lot in Tashma that addresses your question. He was Nifter, I think, in 2004. He's a Zis Vailayit, a wonderful person, very, very special. Really, chaval al da'avdin. He created a field. He certainly contributed a great deal, let's say, not just created a field, contributed a great deal to the field of the history of halacha, wide-ranging knowledge. Knew everything. There's articles here on Poland. There's articles here on Italy. There's articles here on Germany. He knew Spain. He knew everything. I brought, that I'm going to show you later, he wrote a sefer on the Baal HaMor. A fascinating sefer on Reb Zerachya HaLevi Baal HaMor u'bnei Chugo. Hasifrut HaRabbanet b'Provence b'Meyah HaShtemesre. A whole book on the Baal HaMor. We're going to talk about the Baal HaMor in a couple of minutes. So why is the Rif so famous? The Rif is so famous because of what he wrote. Now, let's turn to page 17. Page 17, I xeroxed from the Hakdama of the Rambam to the Mishneh Torah. What I'm doing now is tracing a little bit of the influence of the Rif. So the Hakdama of the Rambam to the Perush HaMishnah is a very important document. We generally don't learn Hakdamas. When I was in yeshiva, we didn't learn the Hakdama. Let's get around the Hakdama. If I want to know what the Pnei Yeshua says, and I'm learning Ksubis, so I learned the Pnei Yeshua and Ksubis, the Gate Meron Daktam. What am I going to get from Daktam? When I was in graduate school, our teacher, Professor Twersky, basically, virtually almost every text that we studied in class was a Hakdama. Certainly, the point of departure of the course, we're going to study a Hakdama. And then from the Hakdama, we went elsewhere. We actually called it, we are majoring in prefaceology. The preface is also important. And it turns out that the Hakdamas are actually very, very significant, certainly historically significant. Take the Pnei Yeshua. The Pnei Yeshua's Hakdama is fascinating. It tells us the whole story about how the Pnei Yeshua became the Pnei Yeshua, because he was a businessman, and then he had a terrible umglik nebuch, and then he was saved from this umglik. Not all the members of his family were saved, but he decided that he was going to devote his life to Talmud Torah afterwards. It's a really inspiring Hakdama. I see on the RCA listserv once in a while, like, any ideas of what I should learn between Mincha and Ma'ariv, any ideas of a little shiur, a little this, a little that. So I'm suggesting to take a look at Hakdamas, to learn, to read through selected Hakdamas. I'll be happy to help you choose those that I think are worthwhile. And it's learning, it's Talmud Torah, work through the Psukim, work through the Mamari Chazal, and it's also very inspiring. To learn about these people's lives and what it is that animated them and what it is that gave them chizuk, and it's something that's very eminently transferable, and it's fascinating. It just this. Sometimes you have to push the text, and sometimes the text carries you. So here the text carries you. It's very easy, and it's very interesting, and it's very meaningful, and it's very spiritually, religiously rewarding. So the Hakdama of the Rambam to the Perush HaMishnayos, you know that in the Perush HaMishnayos there are three major essays. There's the Hakdama to the whole Perush HaMishnayos, and then there's the Hakdama to Avos, which we know is the Shmona Prakim, and then the Hakdama to Perek Chelek. There are three places where the Rambam in his Perush HaMishnayos goes through long introductory comments. And here, in the Hakdama to the Perush HaMishnayos, he goes through a long Shalsheles HaKabbalah. He tells us about how Halacha developed from generation to generation. And he talks on page 17 in the binder about Ravashi, who finished the Bavli. And then he talks about the Yerushalmi, about Rabbi Yochanan, who was the Mechaber of the Yerushalmi, in the middle of page 17. And then he gets into the period of the Gaonim. And he tells us about Gaonic literature. Someday we should devote a whole unit to Gaonic literature. It's a period that we really don't know that much about. We somehow know it exists. We heard of Rabbi Choy Gaon, and we heard of Rabbi Amram Gaon, and we heard of Rabbi Sadia Gaon. But there's a whole ethos in the world of the Gaonim that's worthwhile looking into, including their codification, the codification of the Gaonic period. So he tells us here on the bottom right of page 17. All kinds of things that the Gaonim did. Just three lines from the bottom. V'chein chibru chiburim b'piskei halachos mehem ba'aravit u'mehem b'ivrit. Kigon halachos gedolos, halachos ketuos, halachos pisukos. These are all major Gaonic works that we should at least hear about once in our lives, if not crack the binding and take a look at them. Turn the page 18. The She'iltos of Rabbi Choygon, Va'alochos Ravacha Mishabchu Vizulasa. Now he comes to the Rif. V'ha'alochos She'oso Harava Godel Rabbeinu Yitzchak Zatzal, Hispiku B'mokom Kula. Part of the reason why we don't know about the Alochos Psukos and the Alochos Ketuos is because they were overshadowed by the Rif. Hispiku B'mokom Kulam, Lefi She'heim Kolalim, namely the works of the Rif, Kolalim Kol To Alios Hapsokim v'hamishpatim hanitzrachim bizmanenu ze klomer zman agolus. Anything you need to know in Golus, you'll find in the Rif. You don't have to go anywhere else, because you know that the Rif's work is unlike the Rambam's work, the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. The Rif's work is only halacha lemaisa. In Psachim, the Rif skips the whole middle of Psachim. There's no Rif in the middle of Psachim. In Yuma, he skips shticker Yuma. He goes to the last perek. All the karbonis, he doesn't elaborate on, as opposed to the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, which includes everything. So he's very precise here, the Rambam, that it includes everything you have to know living in Golos, because it's not going to include, there's no Ilchus Beis Abchir in the Rif. Ukvar bira bohem kol ashkiyo shenoflu bepiskei kodmav. V'lo hukshu lonu bohem elo halochos muatos me'atos lo yagiyu le'eser b'shumpanim. Maybe there are 10 places where I ding zuch on the Rif, says the Rambam. So that's already a chash of a thing. Now, they're only, the rest of the time, a makabel, biav, or whatever the Rif says, maybe there are only 10 places. I show you on page 20, where the Rambam in the Tshuva says, maybe there are 30 places where I disagree with the Rif. And actually, for a long time, it bothered me, like Sestir and the Rambam. Here the Rambam says, only 10 places. He disagreed with the Rif, and here the Rambam says that there are 30 places. Omnam, lo yodati, amamar zera, b'yitzhak zalo lo. It's like 6 lines from the bottom of page 20. V'zesha anachnu cholaknu olav b'ktsas makomos kamo lamid makom o yosef. All right. 10 places, 30 places. Even if he only argues with him in 30 places, it's pretty amazing.
Well, couldn't you say that this was later and he discovered
more? So he discovered more? Yeah, wonderful. Professor Tversky, my teacher, in his introduction to the Code of Maimonides, my teacher, Zichrono Livracha, Professor Tversky, wrote a magnum opus on the Rambam. Yale Judaica series has an English translation in the Yale Judaica series of the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam. It's almost all done. It's actually the first book of the Mishneh Torah, Sefer Mada. Sefer Mada is the only one that's not done. Another teacher of mine, or a Rebbe Chaver of mine, Professor Beryl Septimus, will come back to him, who teaches at Harvard. He got the commission from Yale to do Sefer Amada, and he's still sitting on it. It's like 25 years, but I have no tainus to him because I'm also sitting on something for probably 30 years. So it's only Treffer wie se Treffer. Although I had a day job, he didn't have a day job, but still he's a perfectionist. So in the introduction to the whole Yale Judaica series, Professor Tversky wrote a book called Introduction to the Code of Maimonides Mishneh Torah. And there he talks about the 10, the 30, this was later, this was not, I discovered more. Very nice. On page 22, just to draw your attention, I Xerox from Moshe Ibn Ezra. Moshe Ibn Ezra was a poet who wrote a sefer called Shirat Yisrael. He lived into the 12th century. He died somewhere around 1135. And he also speaks very highly about the Rif on page 24. We're going to skip now back to our old friend, the Sefer HaKabbalah, on page 25. And notice that on page 26, in his Shalshelas HaKabbalah, he started with the story of the four captives, the Arba Shvuyim, and then he continues, and now he's up to the Rif, and he tells us about the Rif, and he's one of the earliest, if not the earliest, that refers to the work of the Rif as a Talmud Katan. If you look at the last line on page 26, the Chiber Halachos Kimo Talmud Katan. It's a technical term. It describes what the Rif did, and it's an expression of respect for what it is that the Rif did. To say somebody writes a Talmud Katan, an abridged Talmud, is something very chashuv. And you have the English translation on page 27. You find a similar phrase in the Tzedo LaDerech, page 28, 29, and 30. Tzedo LaDerech, I'm going to come back to the Tzedo LaDerech. one of the things that I want to do is to expose you, to introduce you to major figures in the medieval Jewish firmament that we have no idea about. You know, between the Ramban and the Rashba and the Ritva and the Rush, they don't get any press. So we're busy learning the Rishonim that we know, so we'll throw in other Rishonim. But there are dozens of great Jews who had tremendous impact, who just didn't make the cut. At least their books were printed, at least we have this far. But it's worth cracking a binding and getting a sense about who these Jews were. Rabbi Nachum ibn Zerach is a fascinating Jew. He came from a family that was born in France, and then he himself left, and family was expelled from France. He ends up in Toledo, and he ends up a Talmid of Rabbi Yehuda ben Harash. The Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, that I hope to get to tomorrow, had a number of sons. The most famous son of the Rush, of course, is the Baal HaTurim, Rabbi Yaakov ben Harash. But he had another, Rabbi Yehuda ben Harash. Actually, the Shail Suchuvis are known as Shail Suchuvis Rabbi Yehuda ben Harash. The Rabbi Yehuda ben Harash is in the title of his Shail Suchuvis. He took over for his father when his father was Nifter in Toledo in 1327. So Rabbi Yehuda took over the Rosh Yeshiva Shaft and the Rabbanus in Toledo. And it was at that point when our friend, the Tzedol HaDerech, Rabbi Nachum ibn Zerach, comes to Toledo. He's a Talmud of Rabbi Yehuda ben Arash. He writes a Sefer, which is essentially a mini Shulchan Aruch, which is essentially, the goal is primarily for the courtier class. If you know what's going on in Spain, and I want to talk about this when we get to the general background of the relationships between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, Spain is more assimilated than Ashkenaz. Spain is more acculturated than Ashkenaz. Spain is much more involved with the culture around it, Spanish Jews, than Ashkenazi Jews are involved with the culture around it, for all kinds of reasons that I hope at least to very briefly discuss. So there's this whole society in Spain known as a courtier class that hangs around with the alle feinschmeckers in the court, all the fine people, and they are not necessarily living their lives in a traditional atmosphere. They're not necessarily comporting themselves appropriately. They're not necessarily being nizer, bekalik and vechamura like they should be. And there's a concern that we're going to lose them, and they're bissel tzifil ufgeklärt, and they're bissel tzifil philosophical, a little tzifil acculturated. So Rabbi Nachum ibn Zerach writes a book like a handbook for the courtier class. It's a handbook for these Jews that they should know quick, you know, off and north, without all the lumdis, you know, what do I got to do, how do I do it, and I get a little chizuk and get a little direction. So in the Hakdama, here we go again, here's another Hakdama to the Tzedol HaDerech, he traces also the Shalshelas HaKabbalah. If you look at the bottom of page 29, he talks about the Bavli. A lot of this we don't have time to read every word, I just want to lay it out for you, and hopefully if it interests you, you'll go back and fill it in on your own, to do a study of how later authorities saw earlier authorities. He talks about the Chibur HaBavli, and then he talks about the Gaonim, and then in the last line on page 29, V'achareyem Chibur Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alfasi Shehayim Mikalat Mahmad, that's the same city that the Sefer HaKabbalah in Algeria says where the Rif was born. Ubolus Farad, he comes to Spain, next page. And the Yashav Sham Rabbeinu Yitzchak, the Chiber, at the end of the second line, the Chiber Halachos Bekotzer Plosa Sidre, Vidome Ligemara Zira. So what the Abraham ibn Daud calls Talmud Katan, Rab Menachem ben Zerach calls Talmud Gemara Zira, umiyamos Rabbeinu Hailo kam kamohu, v'nespazer chiburo bekitzveo adama, v'amru olav v'amar olav Rabbeinu Yitzchak Bala Tosfos sheyile ben adam lechaber chibur kamohu, zulasi sheshchina hisashor olav. Already the Ri says that nobody could have written what the Rif wrote unless he had ashura sashchina. V'chai ketishim shana, and he died in the year 1103, Vehem et Talmidim Harbe, Migidole Talmidov. Here the text is Rabbi Yosef ben Menashe. It's probably a mistake. It's probably Rabbi Yosef ben Meir. Rabbi Yosef ben Meir is the Rimagash, and the Rimagash is one of the Rabbeim of the Rambam. So we have a direct line from the Rif to the Rambam via the Rimagash. The last few sections that I want to mention about the Rif is the impact of the Rif and those who commented on the Rif. You know, a Sefer becomes significant when it inspires people either to comment or to disagree. So on page 31, I Xerox just the standard page of the Rif, where the earliest commentators and Balei Plukta on the Rif are found, and that is at the bottom, the Hamor HaKotan and the Hasagas HaRaivid. Both the Hamor HaKotan and the Hasagas HaRaivid, namely both Reb Zrachi Alevi, the Balamor, and the Raivid, Reb Avram ben David, lived in Provence. Provence is southern France. So I think I gave out already a map that has France. It has France. So if you look at France, at the bottom part of France, where you see Marseille, France, where you see Marseille, where you see Montpellier, Carcassonne, Perpignan, all that at the curve of the Mediterranean, that is Provence. Now, it's known as southern France, but culturally speaking, and we'll come back to this, it's a whole separate parsha. It's not Ashkenaz, and it's not Sfarad. It's both Ashkenaz and Sfarad. It's neither Ashkenaz nor Sfarad. My teacher, Professor Tversky, and I Xeroxed a few when we come to the Sefer HaManhig, wrote an article to try to understand Vos Tutzach, what's going on in Provence. Provence is kind of Nishtahin and Nishtaher. He published his doctoral dissertation, my teacher, Professor Tversky, on the Raivid. The Raivid, we know the Raivid mostly as the Baal HaSagas on the Rambam. Well, the Raivid as the Baal HaSagas on the Rambam is the Shmek Tabik of what the Raivid was. The Raivid would be like mortified. He'd be mortified if like his whole fame is based on the few zachaloch that he appended, and he zedled the Rambam, he agreed with the Rambam, he disagreed. That's like mamish, like one nothing, a garnishtel of what he did in his lifetime. And it's bizyonis for him. It's bizyonis for him that like this is all we know about the Raivid. So my teacher came, and it was Paida the Raivid. The book was reprinted in paperback a couple of years ago, Rabat of Paskir, a 12th century Talmudist. This was published in 1962, before it was fashionable to write a history of halacha. He was one of the first who made the academic study of medieval halacha formidable and also fashionable. The Raivid, this Raivid comes from Provence, and the Balamor, or Zrachia, comes from Provence, and both of them write on the Rif. One of the ways to gauge the impact of the Rif is to look at the Balamor and to look at the Raivid. So once again, in order to understand what the Balamor is doing and what the Raivid is doing, you have to look at the Hakdama. You have to look at the Hakdama of the Balamor to his parish on the Rif, and you have to look at what the Raivid has to say. There's another figure who's involved in this debate, and that is the Ramban. One of the great works of the Ramban is not only the Perush al HaTorah, not only the Chidushim on Shas, but the Melchames at the back, at the bottom, in the small print. What's the Melchames? Melchames is going to war. Why? What's he going to war? So the Ramban is going to war to defend the Rif from the attack of the Balamor and the Raivid. The Balamor and Raivid, with all due respect, and they have tremendous respect for the Rif, but they're out to disagree with the Rif. Shticker Balamor, shticker Raivid is anti-Rif, to dingzach with the Rif, and the Ramban is the big savior. The Ramban is coming to fight the Lord's battle, to ratava the Rif from the adamant versions of the Raivin and the Balamor. So I Xerox for you on page 32, the Akdama of the Balamor. We don't have time to look at it. Just look on the top half of page 33, where it's a little bit underlined. That the end of the Akdama of the Balamor to the Rif is where the Balamor tells you what he's out to do. It's important to try to understand the Sefer, like what's the methodology? What are they trying to accomplish? And very often, there's a Hakdama, it'll tell you what they're trying to accomplish. Sometimes there's no Hakdama. Rashi Alator has no Hakdama. So you have to look for hints to find out in Rashi's Perush Alator, what's his method? Besides just what the Pshat is on Pasuk A or Pasuk B, but what's he out to accomplish? The Ramban Alator does have a long Hakdama. And he tells you what it is that he's trying to accomplish. Not always is the Hakdama 100%. Sometimes he writes the Hakdama before he writes the Sefer, and then he writes the Sefer, and then he's off and running, and he doesn't always necessarily end up doing what he says in the Hakdama he wants to do. Sometimes he writes the Hakdama after he wrote the Sefer. If he writes the Hakdama after he wrote the Sefer, then it's much more directly connected to what it is that he already wrote. So it's very interesting to study the Hakdama and to compare programmatic statements in the Hakdama to what it is that Lamaisa he does. So you have here the Hakdama, the Psicha Rabbeinu Zerachia Alevi, at the top of page 32, but the part Negea to us is at the top of page 33, and then on page 34, I Xerox from the Hakdama of the Mulchamas. This is printed in one of Rabbi Chevelle's Kisvei HaRamban. So he has the Hakdama, the Mechames, Iskapitz, and all with all the footnotes. So on page 37, the Kinesi, on page 37, the Kinesi le Rabbeinu Agodo, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, Zichrono Levracha, Kine Gedola, Mipnesha Ra'isi, Lachokim al Dvarov, Shelo Ishiru lo, Kefirov, Machlokoseim, Inyonochon, Bechol Mashadiber. By the time they get through with him, there's nothing left. Nebuch the Rif, Nebuch is in Gansen pulverized. So it's pasgarnish that the Rif should be attacked like this by, he has in mind specifically, by the Balamor and by the Ravid. So I'm going to nem on the Krivda, I'm going to ratav the Rif, Mulchama Lashem, I am fighting God's battle to save the Rif. The Ravid is on page 38, where the line is, you'll see it on your own. And the last text is the Akdama of the Beis Yosef to his Perish on the tour. So on page 39, again a Hakdama. So the Beis Yosef, someday we should devote a whole session to the Beis Yosef and the Ramah. Who was the Beis Yosef? Rabbi Yosef Karo, when did he live? What did he do? What did he represent? So before he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote the Kesef Mishnah on the Rambam. And he wrote the Beis Yosef on the tour. He commented on the two previous codes before he wrote his own code. So you have a code in the 12th century, the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam. You have a code in the 14th century, Rabbi Yaakov Balatur and Ben Harosh. And then in the 16th century, every 200 years, he wrote his own Shulchan Aruch. Before he wrote his own Shulchan Aruch, he was Mefarish the other two. And in his Akdama to the Beis Yosef, the very famous statement on page 40, he talks about he's going to be machriya in three people, and one of the three people, he's going to be machriya to paskin the halacha, the shlosha, amude hora, at the bottom of page 40, halohema harif, the harambam, the harash. So you see in the 16th century, the rif is still sailing along, and he is singled out, the rif, the rush, and the rambam as the majority rule for the Piskei Halacha by the Beis Yosef. On page 42 and 43, I Xerox from the Chida. The Chida lived in the 18th century. The Chida was one of the most fascinating figures in early modern Jewish history. Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai. Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai as a Sfarda Shiyit, huge Talmud Chacham. He wrote like dozens of Sfarim. Very famous Birkei Yosef commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. And he was a traveler. He traveled across Western Europe, the Chida. and he wrote a travelogue, Ma'agal Tov. It's amazing. He wrote a book of travels, and I came to here, and I met this person, and I walked in the street, and I saw this in the street. It's a fascinating book. It's so interesting. And he comes to Hamburg, and he falls into Hamburg right in the middle of the machlokes between Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz and Rabbi Yaakov Vemden, and he tries to stay clear. He walks through minefields, and he describes his visits to all these communities. Describes a visit to Venice. So a couple of years ago, I went with a bunch of Vayli Yidden to Venice, and we went to San Marco Square. If any of you have been to San Marco Square in Venice, so you have the big palace, you have the Doge's palace, and you have the Campanile, and you have the lions. And I whip out the Ma'agal Tov of the Chidah, and he says, in 1772, I was in Venice, and he describes, and I saw the Campanile, Kuf, Mem, Pe, Nun, Yud, Lamed. I saw the Campanile, and I saw the palace, and I saw the lions. And I read it to the Eden, to the Jews, and we looked up, and it's the Mamish. The same thing was fascinating. The Chidah was Mamish standing here. It's so interesting. And among the many things that the Chidah wrote, he wrote the Shema Gedolim. The Shema Gedolim was like little biography look of people who came before him. Little biographies. It's worth taking a look at. You should get the Sefer. If you ever want a little nutshell, besides going to the Encyclopedia Judaica to find out, you go to the Chidah in the 18th century, and we'll see there are a lot of interesting nuggets in the Chidah. So I went to look in the Chidah, Ma'areches Gedolim. He has Ma'areches Sfarim and Ma'areches Gedolim in the Shem HaGedolim. Shem HaGedolim has two chalakim. Each one is a separate volume. The Shem HaGedolim, Ma'areches Sfarim, Shem HaGedolim, Ma'areches HaGedolim, and under Yud, under Rif, Reish Pei Zion, he tells us about the Rif, and I Xeroxed this in particular because on the right-hand side of page 43, in the middle of the column, V'dasha harbe ga'one adoros asu perushim lehilchos ha-Rif. And it gives you a whole list, already by the 18th century, of the luminaries in different countries who had who were influenced by the Rif and who wrote perushim on the Rif. I want to come back to page 44 and through 46 in a second, but I want to just walk you through the rest of this section. Beginning on page 47, there are two articles here that I Xeroxed for you. V'idach Perusha Hizil Gemar. One is an article by Avram Grossman, who is professor emeritus of Jewish history at the Hebrew University. Avram Grossman, really an extraordinary, formidable scholar, particularly of Ashkenaz. Some of you may know his work. He wrote a very important work called Chachmei Ashkenaz HaRishonim. He wrote a very important work called Chachmei Tzorfat HaRishonim. He wrote a number of books. He wrote dozens and dozens of articles. He really opened up our eyes to the history of Halacha in Ashkenaz. So he published an article here that I Xeroxed for you in Pe'amim that was published entitled Me Andalusia LeEuropa. I'm reading now on page 49, Yachasam shel Chachmei Ashkenaz v'Tzorfat b'meyot hayud bet hayud gimel el sefrei ha'alacha shel Rif Rambam. The influence of the Rif and the Rambam on Ashkenaz and Tzorfas, that's directly our issue, the relationship between Sfardim and Ashkenazim. And then, beginning on page 59, an article by the late Toshma, whose name I already mentioned to you, Klitatam shel Sifrei HaRif HaRach Rabbeinu Chananel V'Halochos Gedolos B'Tzorfat U'B'Ashkenaz B'Meyot Hayud Aleph Hayud Bet. Once again, the influence of the Rif is a Sephardi work. It's rooted in Kairouan, it's rooted in North Africa, it's rooted in Spain, where he spent the end of his life, and the influence of this Spanish work on Ashkenaz and Tzorfas. So these are the two articles that I'm suggesting that you read, L'Ravcha D'Milsa, to round out the influence of the Rif. The last thing that I want to bring to your attention is one of the tshuvas of the Rif. On page 44, Shail Su Tshuvas HaRif, is a recent reprint in Tavshin Samaches, Machon Yerushalayim, and Simon Reish Chaf Gimel. So what interests me here is not the Psak Halacha, and not the Lamdis, but the history. To open up our discussion about the relationship between Tsarfas and Ashkenaz and Sfarad in the Middle Ages. She'ela. So we're now in the 11th century. Reuven hoya shochein b'mizrach Tsarfat. Hu v'ishto ubanov rachok misfarad yamim rabim. V'hiniach ishto ubanov b'mekomam. V'nichnas be'eret Sfarad lashut pikilot. So he leaves his family at home and he goes on a trip from eastern France and he goes to Spain. V'avar b'medina achas v'dorash b'rabim. We don't know the name of the community in Spain, but somewhere in Spain. They were so taken by his Torah, they wanted to convince him that he should stay. Aye, what's he going to do with his wife and children? So you'll bring your wife and your children. To go schlep his wife and kids, to go to schlep all the way to Sfarad from Mizrach Tsarfas. So what did they do? Va'osifu lefaiso kama pa'amim. Until they made it worth his while. Ad she'yisratza. V'hisnu imo b'kinyin gamur. She'yitnu lo elu achamisha chav dalet zehuvim something. Gonna give him 24 gold pieces of some Spanish currency. B'chol shana v'shana ad shalosh shana. So they're signing a contract, they'll pay him 24 epices, 24 gold a year for 3 years. And what should he do? V'yikru lefanov v'alocha b'mishnah b'mikra, u'b'peiru shasdorim, u'b'ma she'yirtu, b'kinyon u'b'ksav u'b'edim. V'gamru uven esneimo en b'kinyon she'yovo l'chag asukos emishto u'bonov. Okay, we got a deal. What happened? V'lo igi azman she'kava lahem ad shaboy, showed up early, even before Sukkot. V'samchubo, ah, Machaya, we have a new rabbi, came to the community, schlepped across country, came from all the way from Mizrach Tsarfas, he brought his wife and children, he's going to settle in our community, how wonderful it is. U'mehem sha'amru naschil b'mishnah, u'mehem sha'amru naschil b'talmud. So, sefatzcha shaynon, got five guys paying the rabbi's salary. So what should they learn? So this guy wanted to learn this, and this guy wanted to learn that. Oh, Baruch Hashem, ad she'eskimu kulam be'askama achas v'eschilu b'mesechus brachas v'yikru ubo. Fascinating. Arba ayamim b'shavua. They're going to learn brachas 4 days a week. V'yom chamishi in the fifth day b'mikra. V'yom shishi b'peirush haseder. What is b'peirush haseder? You're learning Gemara for 4 days. You're learning mikra for the fifth day, and on the sixth day, b'peirush haseder. Any suggestions? Any thoughts? What it might be? Maybe it's a commentary on the mikra. I'm not sure what peirush haseder is. The parshas haShavua. So what did they learn on the fifth day? When they learned, maybe the fifth day they went. They started with Bereishis and they went Keseder, and that I don't know. B'peirush haseder. Maybe the Siddur. Oh, maybe they learned the Siddur. They spent the day Friday. They learned Siddur. Okay, maybe. How long is this going to last, that everybody's living b'shalom with each other? So one of them, Yisachar, fang tzachon. I don't understand what he's talking about. It's too complicated for me. I don't want this deal. 4 days we should learn Gemara. Convert fashteachnish. It's too complicated. Elo shetomer lahem shlosha shuros shel Talmud, three lines of Gemara, shanginik, v'tachzor v'tomer lahem shlosha shuros mi Mishnah. It's too advanced for me. Amru chaverov, ein on a rotzim bekach. Al kein amad yisacha v'amar, im kein eini rotzim likros v'lo li tein tzchar. I'm out of here. You don't like it? I'm done. I'm pulling my mug from the barbershop. I'm done. I'm not paying my share. On a Reuven, Nebuch Reuven now is stuck between a rock and a hard place. V'amar yeshtar biyadi b'kinyin ube'edim. What are you doing to me? Ein li elu l'kayim asher b'shtorim asher s'nesim achem. So the shayla is what to do in this circumstance. Since you're plotting to know the psak of the riff, you'll read it on your own. That's why I Xeroxed page 46. I Xeroxed all the way to the end of the riff anything you wanted to know. What interests me now? What interests me now is here's an example. The Rif died in 1103. So in the 10th, in the 11th century, there's a Yidl who's valgering from Mizrach Tzorfas to go to Sfarad, and he brings his learning with him to Spain, and he's trying to cut a deal to be like an informal magichir in the Spanish community. Ad kan hakofa alef, v'idach perushahi. There's a lot more on the Rif. There's a ton more on the Rif. You'll get started with this. At least you have a shtickle of an introduction. We have another 3 minutes. Where are you going? We have 3 minutes.
Take questions.
We have 3 minutes. Okay, we'll take questions. Yeah.
Two things. First, just in terms of this one, do we have any sense where this Shiloh is from?
No. No, where in Spain, you mean?
Do we even know for sure there was Spain?
This is quoted as if the assumption is it's from Spain. The assumption is it's from Spain, yeah.
The term Shas Katan.
Yeah.
How is it educationally the Rif used? Was it actually used as
Yeah, we're going to see. We're going to see that when the Rush came to Toledo, you have to understand, by us, learning Gemara is that's it. What is Gemara? Bavli. Right? Yerushalmi, we don't learn so much. We learn Bavli. For us, learning Gemara Bavli, that's the real thing. In Toledo, in the 14th century, they learned the Rif instead of Gemara. And we'll see that the same Tzedo Laderach tells us that when the Rush came from Ashkenaz to Sfarad, to Toledo in 1305, the Mezuktin Yiddish sat them Gevurim Finster in the Eugen, because they weren't learning Gemara. They were learning the Rif. They had a Kvias in the Rif. And they Paskin from the Rif. And we're going to see a tshuva in the Rush. He's like crazed to paskin not from the Gemara. He comes from the Ashkenazi tradition. The Ashkenazi tradition was you learn Gemara and you learn Tosfos. Tosfos is on the Gemara. It comes out of a limud of the Gemara. He comes to this country where they're not doing that. So Lamaisa, the curriculum was to learn the Rif instead of the Talmud Bavli. Yeah. Yeah, Akiva.
Did Rabbi Young ever tell you who sent him that letter?
So you want to go back to that? You have to read my article. Anything you wanted to know, you read the article.
I don't think you ever pointed that out.
Oh, you remember my article. Yeah, I'm impressed.
Yeah.
Probably for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Probably for a reason. Yeah, Josh.
Yeah, two questions, maybe related. Number one, do we know what compelled the Rif to be the first to write a code? Do we know what compelled the people to write in that tradition?
Yeah. So he's not really the first. Just to go back to the Hakdama of the Parish of Mishnayos of the Rambam, there are already Gaonic codes that predates the Rif. And we don't have a Hakdama of the Rif to understand why he undertook to do what he did. I'm assuming he did it because he felt that it was necessary to write this kind of a code, following in the footsteps of those who preceded him, the Alochos Gedolos, the Alochos Ketsuos, the Alochos Pesukos. But because of its comprehensive nature and because of the authority that he had, he was Olal Kula.
And this might just be a judgment call. Maybe you can answer, maybe you can't. But all the ways of describing the Rif, we've seen the Ruach HaKodesh. And
yeah, huge.
Is that more in the Rif than any other Rishon that you see?
No. You find in a number of different places among Rishonim, the Ruach HaKodesh, Shorsa, Bebes HaMedrash. You find it in a number of different places. For me, it's a way of saying this book is really great. Whether literally they believed that Ruach HaKodesh was Sharso or not, maybe they did. But even if they didn't, they would say it as a way of describing how great the book is. And it's not only the Rif. Yeah.
Question on that, and earlier you find this business of Shasa Ruach HaKadosh based medrash not just about books, you find it about Piskei Halacha.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of the writer about Hadas Ketua and Shasa Ruach HaKadosh
based
Shainim and Paskin's Halacha, so it's not just a book.
That's correct.
And
yeah.
In terms of your,
that's correct. Tversky has it. Yeah.
And what you said about the 14th century Toledo, the Rambam has a shiur in which he says that his primary shiur around the Rif, because people didn't understand the Gemara. Balabas here, who's going home and ruining his rabbi's contract. So this business of burning the Rif has a longer history.
It has a very long history, even before the land. Thank you.
In the Crusader Chronicles, there's also a story that one of the times when the Jews in France, you know, kill off a bunch of people rather than let them go to martyrdom, I think there's one where they killed the women doctor because of the sexual issues.
So I'm not familiar with it, and I'm really interested. I studied the Crusade Chronicles very carefully, and I don't remember it, but if you could show it to me, I would be very grateful. Final comment, yeah.
This Reuven and the Tshuva, do we have any idea what it meant that he was teaching Gemara? Do we have any sense of knowing what that experience was?
Not that I know of. I mean, how did he teach the Gemara? What did he do? There is no Rashi. There is no Tosfos. I don't know. It's a good point. That needs to be part of a conversation on what is Talmud Bavli, what is the impact of Talmud Bavli, what does Talmud Bavli mean before it means what we associate what it means with. I don't know enough to be able to answer that question. Yes.
The Hakam of the Rambam that you mentioned. Cut off right before the Rambam says when he's talking about the Geonim, Harehim Nivdalim Kafri Hevdel Dinatam. He really judges, you know, the Geonim. He says some are better than others, some are smarter than others. Is that common?
The attitude of the Rambam to the Geonim is the subject of an entire book by somebody with the name of a pay that I forget. But Professor Tversky in his Mishneh Torah book has a whole analysis of the attitude of the Rambam to the Gaonim. The Rambam doesn't fall kairim to the Gaonim. The Rambam considers himself independent and sometimes accepting and sometimes critical of the Gaonim. There's a whole book, B'li Neder, I'll bring it if I have it. I know I have it. I don't know if I have it at home or in my office. It's called HaRambam VaHaGaonim, a big fat book. But if you look in Tversky, you'll get the latest on that. The Rambam, not for now, the Rambam was very independent in his thinking and did not feel kafuf necessarily even to people who came before him. Certainly not to the Gaon. All right, sorry.
You mentioned all the different codices that were composed before the Rif, their nature of being quite incomplete. But I think that Bahak stands out as being quite complete and quite similar to the Rif.
Mm-hmm. Does the Rambam quote the Bahak? In the Parashat Mishnayos, I don't remember now. So the Bahag, we don't know who the Bahag is. He quotes the Bahag. So we don't know who the Bahag is. Who's the Bahag? So either Rav Shimon Kayara or Rav Yehudai Gaon. So we don't know. Was the Bahag known very early on? Was it studied very early on? I don't know enough about the history of the impact of the Bahag.
I would gather from some quotes from the Balei HaTosfos that show incomplete quotes.
Uh-huh.
That probably it was around, it was being quoted by others, because sometimes there are different ways to understand how HaTosfos could make a selection that doesn't quite.
I see. So they didn't have direct access to the Bahag.
I don't know what they didn't have direct access.
PA.
I think that sometimes it must have quoted others. It must have been quoted.
And was it also known in Sfarad? Was it known in not just by?
I
okay, let's. Okay, we'll stop here.